the longer the drought lasts, the more impact it will have on groundwater supplies.
Initially, stream flow, because nothing's coming out of the soil into the streams. Eventually, into groundwater and reservoirs, because those inflows become reduced.
Svoboda says more than 61% of the U.S. is in some form of drought, more than double the amount last year. Motivational writer and speaker Stephen Covey has died. The author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People reached millions with his research-based message that principles and character attributes undergird the achievements of the most successful people. He was 79 and died of complications from an April bicycle accident. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. On July 19th, singer-songwriter David Howie will treat audiences to an evening of original Americana-inspired tunes. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In the first hour today, we'll be talking about farm life in America, specifically the life on one farm, but it gives us an opportunity to also talk a little bit about the fact that over time, that family farms in this country have vanished. Our guest for this first hour is Robert Switzer. He is an emeritus professor of biochemistry at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is also the author of a book that is a family story about a farm that had been in his family going back to the time of his grandparents, about some of his experiences on growing up on the farm, and about what happened to that farm. And he tells that story in this book, which is titled A Family Farm, Life on an Illinois Dairy Farm. And it is published by the Center for American Places at Columbia College Chicago and distributed by the University of Chicago Press. He'll be doing a couple of readings and appearances coming up in the next few weeks. He'll be in May on the 19th. At the Barnes & Noble, and then he'll be doing a reading at the Urbana Free Library Thursday, June 7th, at 7 in the evening. And I'll talk about that again later on the show if you didn't quite get that. And if you're interested in the book, of course, you can seek it out. It's a good story, not just because it tells you something about how life has changed in America, but also because it does give you an opportunity to think about what we might be losing when we lose farms like the one that he grew up on. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here, pleased to be invited.
I think that you start here with a statistic that I think is very striking, and it says something about one of the important ways that this country changed over the course of the 20th century, and it has to do with the numbers of people who live on farms.
That's true. The number has decreased from something like 40% of our population living on farms, operating farms around 1900, to something of the order of 2% now. It's a dramatic social change, rather quietly occurring, but a very dramatic change.
And farms certainly have gotten a lot bigger because of mechanization. It's possible for fewer people to work these bigger farms, and that's really what's, I think, behind the movement of people off the farm.
Certainly. Economic and technological changes have driven these forces, and it's almost an inevitable consequence of the market system that we operate under.
Yeah. So this farm that was your grandparents, this is, as the subtitle says, it's in Illinois, way in northern Illinois. It's almost on the border between Illinois and Wisconsin.
That's right. There was just one farm between our farm and the Wisconsin border. And the area there is very much like southern Wisconsin, hilly and very devoted to dairy farming and mixed agriculture.
And this was not a very big farm.
No, it wasn't, 121 acres, although in the history of farming, it was fairly typical for one family to operate about a quarter section or 160 acres, because that's all one family could manage, doing all of the labor with animals and their own labor.
Yeah. And that there, you've just touched on something that I just can't quite get over, and that is your grandfather worked this farm without machinery. That is, when it came time to plow, what he plowed, He did it with a team of horses.
That's true. In some ways, my grandfather was a little bit backward even for his time. His style of agriculture was virtually the same as in the 19th century. He never used any internal combustion engines except for a clumsy old motor for pumping water. There was no electricity on the farm, no running water, although that was typical of farms in that time. And he relied entirely on animal and human labor. And in addition, because he had only a daughter and a fairly small and frail daughter at that, he didn't do as so many farmers did and rear many sons who helped him with his labor. So it was my grandfather and my grandmother who did it themselves.
That's just, when you that part in the book where you talked about the fact that a certain amount of the farm was devoted to be either grain or corn, and that he plowed that with horses and a moldboard plow, and it took him to plow. He said it was an area the size of what, like 40 football fields?
36 football fields. I thought if you just talked about acres, many people...
Nobody knows what that
right,
is.
Right, but they know what a football field is. Yeah. But 36 of them laid back to back. Yeah, I can't imagine how he did it.
And he did it all by himself, and I think you said it would, to do that, to start to finish, would take him 10 days?
Just for the plowing.
Just for the, yes. And then, of course, there would be more.
Right.
More,
the land would have to be disked and harrowed and planted.
Yeah. It's just really hard to fathom. I can't really quite fathom, you know, what it would be like to do 300 acres and to have a tractor. But just to do that and do it all by yourself walking behind those horses, I just can't quite imagine.
I think later, at first he plowed with a single moldboard plow, but later he had a larger double moldboard plow so that that required a team of three horses and could plow at least twice as fast. But it's still a slow process. Yes.
That's it. Just and the thing that really comes through is just how hard that life would have been and how hard your grandparents would have had to work to sustain life.
I think that's right. I didn't want to write a sentimental book. There's a lot of sentimental things out there written about family farming. As we look back, it seems a charming life. But in fact, it was a very, very physically demanding life. And I think it was especially difficult for farm wives who did a lot of physical labor in the fields. My grandmother helped milk cows by hand twice a day and had responsibility for a household and a very large garden and canning the produce of that garden for the winter.
Yeah. Did things slow up much for the winter time?
Yes, they did. At least there wasn't much field work, but they still had, of course, the milking and what other livestock they were raising. Mm-hmm. And it was fairly typical to harvest the corn as they needed it from the shocks out in the field. So they would go out with either a wagon or a sled and husk the corn from the shocks as they needed it and bring in the fodder for the cattle as well. So that was a winter chore out in the fields. Otherwise, they could retreat to the semi-warmth of the house and barn.
Well, how much did your grandfather pay for this land when he acquired it? This would have been, 1916?
Yes. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that was a moment when farmland prices and the products prices that farmers were getting hit a peak right after the end of World War I. And so that was a bit of a land boom, and so he bought high. I think, if I recall correctly, he paid something of the order of $20,000 for the 121 acres, which was a very large sum of money. And then he and grandmother were saddled with the mortgage and only paid it off near the end of the 30 years they were there.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, of course, it wasn't all that long after that we had the Depression.
Right, which for farm families actually started at about 1920 or 21 with the collapse of prices after World War I. And the Depression was really quite severe during the 20s. I found when I was doing background research that there were more farm bankruptcies during the 20s than there were in the 30s. And so in the 30s, the weakest performers had already been weeded out.
Can you just talk a little bit about what happened to prices just over that relatively short period of time, say between the time that they started living on that farm and started working it to the point where just a handful of years later they took a big dive?
Yeah, I don't recall the exact numbers, but in general the prices dropped by at least 50% in the 20s, and stayed there, and then dropped again by another 1/3 to 50% in the 30s.
Mm. I seem to recall, was it there at one that you were making a comparison between two points relatively close together, where, say, corn was at one point maybe a little over 70 cents a bushel, and then it was not that long before it was less than 40 cents
yes.
a bushel.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did they survive this?
Well, they used very little cash. They needed relatively little cash except to pay the interest on the mortgage, and just finding that was a struggle. Mm-hmm. They could raise their own food, of course. Mm-hmm. They could raise and slaughter livestock. They had a big garden and fruit trees and so on. So they needed cash for a relatively small number of things off the farm. So as long as they didn't just completely default on the mortgage, they would be able to get by. Yeah. And so they did.
Do you think that they would say that they had a good life, a happy, well, maybe those are two different things, good, happy, and satisfying? You could ask any of those things, and maybe those are really three different questions.
They reflected the lives that they had grown up in. Their parents had been farmers too. Mm-hmm. And I think, although they knew it was hard, they weren't surprised. They already knew that that was the life they had chosen. And so they would have said it was a solid and reasonably successful life. Mm-hmm. To say that it was happy, I think, probably isn't true. You have to remember that I was a child when I knew my grandparents, and they were elderly, and at least my grandmother in poor health, and mm-hmm. they were pretty exhausted from their years on the farm. And certainly my grandmother did not seem to be a happy person. My grandfather was a more laid-back, philosophical sort of fellow, and managed, I think, his years of retirement were simple but content.
Yeah. And that was when, at the point he retired, he moved off the farm. This was when your parents then took
That's
over
correct.
Running it.
Right after the war.
So how much longer did your grandfather live after that?
Oh, he lived for something of the order of 14 years oh. after that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Grandmother died fairly shortly after they retired, but mm-hmm. Grandpa lived on alone for quite a few years.
And was there a point, do I remember that there was actually a point where you were living in the house, your parents were living in the house, and your grandparents were?
Yes, when we first
moved there. In the farmhouse?
That's right. When we first moved there in 1946, it was a very large farmhouse. It had been actually expanded to accommodate two families by the Barmore family, who were the founders of the family, of the farm. So there was plenty of room. But it became clear that both my family and my grandparents would be happier if they lived in separate houses. And so they moved to a town about 10 miles away over in Wisconsin, Monroe, uh-huh. Wisconsin.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Bob Switzer. He is Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Illinois. We are talking about what you will find, the story that you will find in his book, A Family Farm. The subtitle is Life on an Illinois Dairy Farm. And in this book, he writes about the farm that was his grandparents and then his parents. He grew up there, but he and a brother did not want to be farmers, and they moved away. And so at the time that his dad passed away, then they ended up selling the farm. So it's a story of the period roughly from about 1919 to 1991.
That's correct, 1916 to 1991.
1916 and 1991. And again, the book is published by Center for American Places. It's distributed by University of Chicago Press. Questions, comments, certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So your grandparents only had one child, your mom.
That's right.
So she grew up on the farm. How did she feel about being a farm girl?
She didn't have much affection for it. I owe a great deal to my mother, and I resemble her in many, many ways. She was a very scholarly person. She loved school. She was the valedictorian of her little high school class, and because of that was able to get a scholarship to start her education at Carthage College, which is now in Kenosha, Wisconsin, but at that time was in Carthage, Illinois, a small Lutheran college, where she also shone as a student. She wasn't able to finish, would not have been able to finish if she had not had a lot of financial help from an aunt and uncle who recognized her talents. And she studied biology with a professor who was locally well known. And those interests certainly influenced me in my choice of a profession. But she was not happy on the farm, and she was not very happy to go back there when my father elected to move there after the war.
Yeah. There again, you're going back to reading the stories about what the farm was like when your grandparents were there, and about life being hard. And I'm sure that being a child, and you know, being a farm kid, you're expected to work. And as you get older and bigger and stronger, what you're expected to do gets more and more and more. So I'm sure that for farm kids, life is not is there. I'm sure there are pleasant moments one recalls, but overall, I'm sure that it's equally hard, as maybe almost as hard as it is to be a grown up.
There are a lot of demands on farm children. I don't think either my brother or I felt that we were particularly hard treated as compared to the other farm kids that we knew. We all worked on the farm. We all got up and helped with milking and did chores in the morning before going to school. We all worked in the fields. And as we got older and stronger, more and more was required of us. But, of course, during that time, my father was mechanizing the farm. So we learned to use tractors and operate machinery. So some of the real physical drudgery was taken out of it. The farm had been electrified in probably the late 30s or early 40s through the Rural Electrification Program. And my parents began to modernize the old house, so the quality of life got better. I can't say that I certainly learned to work and to work hard and to take pride in accomplishments, but I can't say I ever learned to love the farm.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like it was oppressive or anything. Just that kids were expected to work.
Absolutely,
and you certainly worked hard and did. When as you and your brother got bigger and stronger and more physically able, you did the kind of same work that the adults did.
Exactly, and that's perfectly normal on farm life. Probably still is on those farms that are family operated.
One of the things, again, I was really struck by reading about the story, just going back to when your mom was a little girl, that even though the farm, I think it was 5 miles from the town
The
school was, there were times of year where it was so difficult to get back and forth that your mother would live so she could go to school. She boarded in the town.
That's correct. Now, when she went to the grade school, fortunately, that little school, one-room school, was right on the corner of our farm. And my brother and I went to exactly the same school. It had been modernized a little, but not a lot. Mm. But the high school was in the village of Orangeville, 5 miles away. And, yes, she boarded in Orangeville. I'm not sure if it was the whole year, but certainly during the winter months, because she couldn't get back and forth with a team of horses and muddy roads.
Yeah, so the roads were just, at that point, they were just that bad, so that the idea of just hopping into the wagon and going to town, you weren't going to do that.
No. In the section that my father wrote, he describes the same sort of situation for him and for his brother and sister to go to the high school in Mount Carroll. They were trying to use automobiles, and they had a real struggle with the mud and the like, and often use horses and sleds instead in the winter.
Yeah. So there is a great picture in here of you in that one-room school. You, I think you and your brother are both in the picture. And so it was that same school that your mom had gone to. You know, when was that school established? How long had it been there?
I think it was established sometime in the late 19th century, probably about 1880 or 1890. On a plot of land that the farmers donated. And the building was modified a bit by the time my brother and I went there. But it was still a one-room school, all 8 grades, one teacher. And not a bad education, actually. I have few complaints about those years in there.
Well, it gave you a good enough foundation to go on to get a PhD.
So yes.
It gave you a pretty good start there.
It did. And I have to say how grateful I am to the University of Illinois, because, as you can imagine, that was one of the very few possibilities for higher education that I could afford. Mm-hmm. And I had a small scholarship to come here, and I discovered after I got here it was a fabulous place to study chemistry. It changed my life completely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Somebody on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, and happy life after the radio, David. I read in Patterns that you're going to retire, so I wanted to say that first.
Well, thank you.
And Celeste as well. My question is, your guest and I thought maybe the PhD was in history, but I have a historical question, and his views on the feudalism, and which is still alive in some places, and then as the farm extended to the extended family, and then, as he just said, in hard times there were many people living in one place. And that paradigm of imperialism seems to have consumed all human activity, and we are only considered as consumerists who have no life and or intellect, and the march goes on. And it is just, now with just the nuclear family is all that remains, and that, among some classes, is very thin as well. And I wondered if you might comment on that, and I'll ring off. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
the caller is correct that I am a PhD in biochemistry, not in history, so I can't comment knowledgeably about farming in the period before the 19th century in the United States. So how feudalism evolved into the kind of agricultural patterns that we see or saw then, I can't really say much about. It is true that the forces that brought so many family farms out of existence were economic forces, and it's a kind of a economic Darwinism that it can be a bit ruthless. And yet, I don't see an alternative to those forces. I don't see how the nation can be expected to sustain a highly uneconomic form of agriculture.
All right. I hope that gets at the caller's question. Let's go. We have a couple of Urbana people. Go next to line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book, but I read a book by John Grisham, a novel called The Painted House, and it was about, it fictionalized the situation, but it was the very same kind of thing, and it impressed me a lot. And the whole situation with farms, I mean. And what I'm curious about is, because there's such a big movement now towards organic farming, does that seem likely to bring back more of the family farm situations, or is it more likely to just be that they only have peach organic farms?
I think that there is a niche for family farms in these kinds of specialized agriculture. Organic farming is certainly one of them. Farmers who are astute at producing and marketing special products, including organic products. I don't see that as a large segment of American agriculture, but more kind of a niche that does allow some families to survive. But the big industrialized, mechanized farms, I think, will still produce the largest portion of our agricultural products.
That's just exactly the part that bothers me. I saw the thing that was on the show on WIRL TV a couple weeks ago about that. And that huge, this thing we got into with these huge farms and mechanized farms and so on, has also been producing food that don't keep people healthy. That are really causing a lot of problems, and so much of our disease process and everything in this country, I think it's fairly well documented, is because of the food we eat and because the mechanized farming and the large farming makes things inexpensive, relatively. So I'm kind of hoping that little by little, as more and more people realize that there will be an even bigger movement toward organic farming.
Yeah, if the market forces reinforce that change, why then it should develop.
Okay. Well, again, we'll go on to some other callers here. We'll go next to line number two. I think this is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Casey. I've read Professor Switzer's book, and it's wonderful. It's chock full of fascinating facts, but it's a very, very good read, and it's very approachable. And it's beyond the story of his family. It's a testament to the American spirit. I mean, the people who built America. You know, this book just works on many different levels. But I would like to know from Professor Switzer what prompted him to start writing this memoir. I mean, was there an event? Did something happen? What, you know, prompted him to just sit down and pick up the pen and start recollecting?
Well, there were several intersecting impulses. One of them was a challenge thrown down to me by my son, who is a graphic designer. He said some 10 years ago, maybe longer, "Daddy, let's do a project together." And I asked, "Well, what can a biochemist and a graphic designer do?" And he said, "Well, you can write a book and I'll do the graphic design." And that's actually what actually eventually happened. It took a very long time. I've always been interested in writing and in literature, and now that I've retired from active research at the university, I needed a creative outlet, and this was my first attempt to find that creative outlet in writing, and it's been a delightful experience.
Does that get at your question? You
yeah,
want to follow?
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good.
Thank you.
And we'll go again to another caller here. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. Have you ever read the Yearbook of Agriculture from, I think it was 79? It was put together under the direction of Secretary Freeman, who had been governor of Minnesota. You may have trouble finding it because the Reagan administration destroyed as many copies as they could.
Well, that's an interesting story. The Yearbook of Agriculture appeared, if I'm recalling correctly, annually from the Secretary of Agriculture. In the research that I did for this book, I looked up quite a number of earlier volumes. They're found in the ACES Library, which is a fabulous resource for research in this area. But I didn't, I wasn't aware of any special character to the 79 volume, and there sounds like there's a story there I'd like to know more about.
Well, it was a study of agricultural efficiency, and they compared large farms and medium and small farms, and they found the optimum level of efficiency was reached at about 250 acres in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
They also found that a Mexican farmer operating a 30-acre farm, vegetable farm in California was more efficient than the large farms. The Reagan administration didn't like these findings, and so they destroyed as many of the books as they could before they left the warehouse.
Hmm.
But it doesn't appear that it was inevitable that the family farm disappear. It was largely a political decision, beginning with the Eisenhower administration, which wanted subdivisions and moving as many people into the city as possible and getting rid of the farmers. And that was another the influence of another Secretary of Agriculture. But anyway, I would suggest you read this, because I don't think it was as inevitable as you may suppose. It's been projected by some experts that we will probably end up with about 16 or 20 farms in the state of Illinois.
Well, that's quite a vision of the future.
We're moving there.
Uh-huh. Well, this is something that I need to think about some more. I mean, as I wrote this book, I wrote it from the perspective of the small farmer and what he saw happening on a micro scale. And most farmers were not really in a position to evaluate any larger political machinations of the sort you're describing.
How large was your farm?
121 acres, very small.
That was a bit small even in those days.
Yes.
Of course, the 80 had been the standard farm a generation earlier. I enjoyed farming. I was a little later than that, and I ultimately went to college and ended up working with computers. But I would say that kids on farms had a mixed experience. The ones who liked farms liked working with livestock and machinery, often liked the life very well. And the ones who didn't hated it.
I guess I was one of the latter. Although one of the comments I make in the book is that the farms that thrived and expanded, not to necessarily to enormous farms, but to farms of several hundred acres, and, mm-hmm. and were intergenerational and added modern equipment and modern buildings and so on. Often were those where the family structure worked in a positive way. There was a father, a patriarch, who made partners of his sons or his sons-in-law and found ways for them to be to profit from the farm's growth and its well-being. And so those farms did well. My father was less of a partner in that way, and perhaps had he been more encouraging, my brother or I might have stayed on.
I think that's a very astute statement. I grew up raising purebred livestock, and that probably made it a very different experience for many.
That's true. Most farmers don't raise purebred livestock. That's a somewhat specialized kind of farming.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, and I certainly have to read your book.
Oh, please do. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. We are talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Robert Switzer. He is Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at University of Illinois and is author of the book A Family Farm, which is about his family's farm. This was a farm that first was worked by his grandparents beginning in 1916, and then his father and mother worked it, and then when his dad died, the decision was made to sell the farm. That was in 1991. And so in part it's family history, but it's also about the fact that farms like this have disappeared and are continuing to disappear from the landscape. I do want to mention that Bob will be doing a book signing at Barnes & Noble Saturday, May 19th, 1 to 3 in the afternoon, and then he'll be also doing a reading at the Urbana Free Library on Thursday, June 7th at 7 in the evening. So a couple of opportunities to meet him. If you want to read the book, you can go out and look for it. We talked a little bit about the fact that your grandparents, they only had one child, your mom, who was maybe not real happy being a farm girl and certainly didn't want to be a farm wife. But I guess what happened was when she married your dad, there were farms in both of their families. And so the question was, well, what's going to become of these farms? And the decision was made, I guess your dad made the decision, that your grandparents' farm was the one.
That's
correct. And so they went to live on this farm.
That's correct. They belong to a generation where the husband pretty well made the decisions in the family. And the only profession he really knew was farming, because he'd grown up on a farm. His father's farm would have been available, but he had two siblings whose shares would have to be bought out, and it was a very backward farm, even more backward than my mother's family's farm. And mother was an only child, so she would eventually inherit the farm outright, although what happened was that my grandfather transferred the farm to them for a very small price late in his life. So it was a practical decision, as long as they were committed to a life of farming. Mm. So, as I've said in the book, it was not a decision that my mother welcomed. And I suppose her attitude infected my attitude toward the farm.
Yeah. It's a rather sad story to read, particularly how unhappy she was later in life.
Yes. That is unfortunate. I just really regret that. And she had been so frustrated in her early dreams by the Great Depression that I think maybe there was never going to be a great recovery from that. She took some pleasure in her children's lives and her grandchildren's lives until late, when she became a bit more depressive. And perhaps some of that was just built into personality. Mm. I don't know.
So she was interested in biology. That got you interested in biology.
That plus the fact I was living in a world of biology.
If you live
on a farm, I mean, there are both domestic and wild creatures all around, and so I was in a living laboratory. Mm-hmm. But yeah, her books and her pickled specimens and microscope slides and so on had been my toys. And then once I began to study science in high school, I was hooked. It was wonderfully exciting.
So you have one brother. So the two of you were the only kids of your parents, and he went off to the work world. You went off to academe, and it seems that the two of you never really looked back.
Not really. I think my brother had more emotional connections to the farm than I did. He lived near there, and he and his wife were enormously helpful to my father when he was in his declining years. But he didn't miss farm life. He wanted to form his own way of life, and he did.
Yeah. So you do you I know that I think, or at least I think, that you're maybe had some regrets about the family place being sold, and yet at the same time you yourself were never going to be a farmer, and so when your mom died and then your dad continued to live there, and eventually when he passed away, then there didn't really seem to be much choice but to sell it.
There didn't. Dad pleaded with us to keep the farm in the family, and that there was a very sad episode in which we talked about that, and my brother and I wouldn't lie to him. We told him that we would sell it. It was a sad moment, a very painful moment. This was a place to which I had very deep attachments, in spite of whatever how keenly I may have wished to leave it when I was a teenager. But it was inevitable. What I'm happy about is that a family, Don and Joyce Bates, bought the house and bought about 6 acres around the land, and they loved the old place, and they put enormous effort into restoring the old house and the barn, and they're not going to fall into ruin the way most farms do. It's a pleasant place.
Yeah.
And going to last for many more years.
So I guess the house was in kind of bad shape.
It was in poor shape.
<bought it.
laughs> Very poor shape, and they did a great deal to make it livable and pleasant.
And so I'm sure that it's good for you to, you know, the fact that the house is still standing and that there's somebody living there and that they're really attached to it and they're committed to see the house continue to be a place of life.
That's very satisfying. And the Bates have been extremely welcoming. I went there when I was in the process of writing the book and took photographs and talked to them at great length, and they were delighted. So that's a happy outcome. You'd see so many abandoned buildings along the roads. Gray and windowless houses. You know that those were places where stories like my family story took place. Lots of them.
Yeah. Let's go. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with somebody on our line number two. This is Champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you to follow up on things that have been brought up already. Your brother's perspective and the discussion of generations that stay versus go. But from your experience with others in your high school or in the town or in the region, others who were about the same age, did they fall into the old image of some needed to run away from what was too difficult, while others were drawn to a dream and wanted to pursue that? When you think back on your generation and the people you knew, was there a pattern of some leaving being pushed out and some leaving being drawn out? Thank you.
There was a pattern amongst, say, my high school cohort, in that the majority of them do not live on or operate farms today and did not after they left high school. And again, I think this is largely driven by economic forces. I think there were some who continued to operate farms for most of their lives, some who started to operate farms and left farming over the following few years. Relatively few from my small rural community went on to college and were so drawn, as I was strongly drawn, to a professional career. But they tended to settle in the area and work in businesses in the community. Their emotional state I can't really comment on, whether they were eager to leave or regretted having to leave, I can't say. I don't think most of them were quite as keen to leave as I was.
Well, I know that as you have said, you were in it. Part of you was sad to see the sale of the farm. Realistically, though, we've talked about the farm. It was certainly by today's standards is pretty small.
Yes.
Would it have been economically viable if you or your brother, say, had decided you wanted to live there and continue to work it?
not without some very radical changes in the kind of agriculture that we practiced. Mm-hmm. One of the callers talked about organic farming or what I call specialty farming or boutique farming. Mm. If we had been interested in and willing to invest in some kind of specialized agriculture and shrewd enough to know how to market our products, it might have been able to support a family. But it would have required some real ingenuity, some serious investment, and some very hard work. And we were, by that time, in our 50s and well committed to other careers, so it was not a possibility we even considered.
And was it, do I remember right, that the land was bought by one of the neighbors, so it became part of an adjoining farm?
That's correct, yeah. That's a pretty common pattern. The farmers pay premium prices for adjacent land because it's much easier than to farm.
Right. Okay. Another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I was going to ask the professor this question. My grandparents had farmed. I'm in my late 50s, so I kind of remember similar experiences on the farm as he grew up with a little bit as the small scale of it. And I know they would be astounded to look at the way row crop farming is done today with the size of machinery and equipment. And one of your previous callers speculated on that there might be only 15 or 16 farms in the state of Illinois in the future. And I find that a bit of a stretch. I mean, just the logistics of moving equipment and people into place and trying to do it in a timely fashion is just difficult. Farming within two or three counties like a lot of the guys do today. So, and then the high price of the farm ground that has been sold here in the last year and a half, a lot of the land is being bought up by funds and so forth. And I just wondered what the professor thinks of the inevitability of those types of operations as time goes forward and what that will have, what impact that will have on agriculture. And the things that he studied in writing this book, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
I should stress that I'm not an expert in agricultural economics. I have noticed, though, that farmland prices have been rising rapidly in the last couple of years, partly because the prices of farm products have been rising. But it reminds me a bit of something that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, where we had a similar boom in agricultural prices, land prices, that was then followed by a real crisis. You remember the farm aid crisis in the early 80s and a lot of bankruptcies. So I worry a bit about the speculative bubble in land. It's very dependent upon sustained high prices for agricultural products, and I think that's very difficult to predict. I also agree that mega farms seem unlikely, at least here in Illinois. I think that they will be large and highly mechanized, and they involve huge capital investments, but a number of 16 or 20 seems unlikely to me.
We are talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Bob Switzer. He is Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry at University of Illinois and is author of this book, A Family Farm, Life on an Illinois Dairy Farm. And it is about this farm where he grew up, a farm that had belonged to his grandparents and then was worked by his parents, a small farm right in northern Illinois, almost at the border between Illinois and Wisconsin. Relatively small, 120 acres. And he writes this story, and it's published by the Center for American Places at Columbia College Chicago and distributed by the University of Chicago Press. And he will be doing a couple of readings locally. And just, again, right before the end of the program, I can give you that if you've just joined us. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I'm just looking at the jacket here of the book, and there's a picture on the back that clearly this was the auction. This was the sale.
That photograph was taken during the auction, and there are numbers of others in the book. One of the properties of the book that I'm very proud of is that it's so richly illustrated with family photographs going from the early years through the end of the farm, and there's a montage of those photos from the day of the auction. There's also an appendix by the great-grandson of the farmer who established the farm in the 1850s and built the old buildings that still stand, the house and the barn. And they contain his family history up to the time that they sold the farm in 1911, just shortly before my grandparents bought it, and some lovely architectural drawings of the old buildings.
Yeah, and also it's nice that there you also have some memories of your children, some of the experience they had of their grandparents and their grandparents' farm.
Yes, and their perspective was a lot more cheerful than mine. they found it a fascinating place to go and play, and as they grew older, they became clearly aware of the farm's decline and especially their grandfather's old age. So they felt the poignancy of what was happening. But they loved the farm in a way that children often do when they visit Grandpa's farm.
Yeah. Well, they certainly would. They'd be in a position to enjoy the things that would be there to enjoy and not really have to have the burdens that the adults would have about the, you know, the big issues about economics and politics and survival, and they could just go there and have a great time.
They didn't have to get up at 6 in the morning and milk cows and then do it again at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Although there is a story in here, I think it's your son, writes about how they were there at once and they were both in bed, and Grandpa said, get up. Time to get up. And
even after he sold the cows, he insisted on getting up early and then going, as he said, to feed his livestock, which consisted of a group of scruffy farm cats that he fed out in the barn. It just was in his blood. He had to get up and do his chores.
So he lived there until he passed. Right?
He did. He lived there for 14 years after mother died. And even though he was legally blind and very arthritic, that was his kingdom. And he stayed there until 2 weeks before he died.
Yeah. It's just remarkable. I'm sure that you're very pleased to have this story and to have it down. So many people, I'm sure, have family stories and they're lost, and time to time I'm sure people say, gee, we should do something like this as an exercise even just for us, and it doesn't happen, and then the stories are gone.
That's true, and I would encourage people to record their family histories in that way. When I talk about this book, I'm always amazed at how many people come up and just spontaneously want to talk about their family farm. It's really in our national blood, and people have a resonance for this, and they want to talk about it. They want to remember.
Yeah. Let's do at least one more caller here, someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Yes. A little clarification upon what I said earlier. The estimate of 15 or 20 farms in Illinois was that of a recognized agricultural economist. And there are places in the West where units are actually, say, hundreds of thousands of acres, and this is grain farming. I suppose the organization would be a central office which would manage buying and selling of commodities, with unit managers managing maybe tens of thousands of acres or less. If that clarification helps any in understanding what the projection was, I hope it does.
Bye. Okay. Yeah, thank you for that. I must say it's a form of agriculture that is so completely foreign to my experience of it that I would hardly recognize it.
Yeah. And, well, I'm sure that that a lot of people would be really unhappy if such a thing did indeed come to pass.
It would be unrecognizable, and there are potential efficiencies, but also potential abuses that would require, I think, some oversight.
Yeah. We're coming to the point here where we just have a couple of minutes left. I just mentioned a bit ago the fact that here on the back of the book is a picture from the day that the sale took place in 1991, and there are other photos in here. And this obviously was very, very emotional time for you. Can you talk about some of the feelings of that day?
There is an episode in the book that describes the day of the auction that I have difficulty reading aloud without getting a tight place in my throat.
Yeah.
In a way, it's puzzling because I didn't make a secret of the fact that I yearned to leave the farm. But any place where you've lived and spent so many years and where people you care deeply about have lived and given their lives is a place that's in your blood, and it is painful to lose it. I felt that very strongly. Those rooms were so empty and so barren, and it seemed in some ways that their lives had not yielded very much to them.
Yeah.
They had given a great gift to me, but to my grandparents and my parents, it didn't seem like they had been very well rewarded for their years on the farm.
So for you, is this book something of a memorial?
Yes, definitely. It's dedicated to my parents and my grandparents, and maybe most especially to my mother.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's for someone, you know, like me, for example, who has no personal experience of farming, and of course, as time goes along, fewer and fewer people will have had that experience. I think it offers a window into a kind of life that is certainly vanishing, and at one time was much more common than it is now.
If the book captured that for you, then it's been successful. I'm very pleased.
Well, I want to mention one more time here that our guest, Bob Switzer, who is Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry, University of Illinois, will be talking about his book. The title of the book is A Family Farm. It's distributed by the University of Chicago Press. He'll be doing a couple of appearances here in our area. He'll be doing a book signing at the Barnes & Noble on Saturday, May 19th. Between 1 and 3 in the afternoon, and then he'll also be doing a reading. You'll have an opportunity to meet him. This is at the Urbana Free Library. This will be Thursday, June 7th, 7 o'clock in the evening. Of course, you want to read the book, you can head out to the bookstore and find it. And thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. I'm pleased to have been here.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
Organ donation is encouraged as a gift of life. Tissue donation can be the same.
We're recovering skin, bones, tendons, heart valves, veins, those sorts of things.
It's also big business.
Instead of being stewards of the gift, the company was actually looking at each donor as a profit machine.
An investigation of the human tissue industry. That begins today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where we are moving into the final hours of trading for this session. And corn and soybean futures have traded both sides of the open today in what has been a fairly choppy affair. Corn and soybeans have been down as much about a dime, but they are now trading in positive territory as there has been little change in the 10-day weather outlook for the central U.S. and continuing decreases in crop rating conditions, both in both sides, the best part and the good, the excellent, as well as in the poor to very poor. That has the market on edge as it continues to focus on weather concerns. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. in Kansas City, September wheat is now $8.99 and a quarter, up 14 and three quarters. March is $9.24 and a half, up 14. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at $8.93 and a quarter, $83.93 even now, up 8 and a half. March of 13 at $9.09 and three quarters, up 6. September corn, $7.87 and a quarter, up 10 and a half. It's been as high today as $7.96 and a half.